got sound.
Yeah, I've got sound also. Thanks,
Madam Chair. House Judiciary has called to order 1:20, and it is May the 9th. Present for the record are Representatives Cott, Anderson, Sierra, Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. I do have a quorum to conduct business, and we're going to start with House Bill number 132 today, the Human Rights Commission bill. Where we left off, we had closed public testimony and we were working on amendments, but just so that the committee knows, Jan DeYoung from the Department of Law is available to answer questions. Kelly Fisher and Grace Marcus from the Human Rights Commission are online, and Michael, pardon me, that's for the next bill. So those three individuals are available if anyone has questions or needs them. So Representative Gira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So did we do any amendments the other day?
Amendment 1 was adopted, Amendment 2 was offered and withdrawn, Amendment 3 was left pending, and that was your amendment, Representative Guerra, to change time frame. And Vanessa, I believe, has a better idea of the what you were...
Amendment 3 was page 2, line 7 and 9, line 9, 180 days and insert 1 year or 365 days.
So, Madam Chair, I move Amendment number 3. And just for purposes of discussion, the state's position is that we should have the shortest statute of limitations possible, 180 days, allowed under federal law. Under federal law, the statute of limitations is 180 days, but 300 days if in some circumstances. The argument is we should keep our law as limited as the federal law is. I don't understand why we'd want to do that. Our law doesn't have to be as weak as the federal law is. And I think a one-year statute of limitations makes sense. It doesn't. We have every right to have our law read differently than federal law. The backup would be that, truthfully, federal law allows 300 days, not 180 days. But I would just move a one-year statute of limitations. So I'd move amendment number 3.
I would object.
Okay, there's an objection. Do you want to speak to it?
Just the same comment as last time, that I've worked in cases, and Representative Guerra and I talked afterwards. We both have kind of war stories, pro and con, good and bad, but I've seen abuses as well, and I think 180 days is sufficient for someone to know. I mean, they should know during the act if there's a human right violation. I would assume they know that that's occurring to them. They wouldn't figure it out 6 months later, and 6 months is ample for them to seek counsel and repair that through a grievance.
Representative Guerra, did you find out what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission had?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they have a rule. Just their summary to us says the 180-day filing deadline is extended to 300 days if the charge is also covered by a state or local law. So theirs is 300 days in effect because we have a state and local law. The response to Representative Anderson would be, you don't want to force people to file lawsuits or claims when they're working things out informally at work. So somebody's discriminated against, they decide they're going to try and work it out with their employer. By making it 180 days, you're asking them to essentially be sue happy and start and do this very controversial complaint against their own employer, or else lose their rights. And if you give them a year, they can try and work things out amicably without involving the state, without involving the courts. And 1 year is, that's half of what we give most victims of any sort of injury in court. So 1 year seems reasonable.
I would just respond that it's not always a victim, though. I mean, that doesn't always mean that because you file a lawsuit, it's accurate and truthful.
Any further discussion on amendment number 1? Madam Secretary, you call the roll.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Cotts.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Bloomberg is not here. Representative Guerra.
Yes.
4 yes, 2 no.
So amendment number 1 carries. Amendment number 2, Representative Guerra.
I believe that was amendment number 3, Madam Chair.
Pardon me, amendment number 3.
Amendment number 4, let's make this the one that says page 4, line 15 to 19. And I'm actually going to probably reword this, but if page 4, lines 15 to 19 say that at any time after an accusation is filed, the employer can move to have the case dismissed. I'm a little worried by that because sometimes early on in a case, you haven't had your chance to do your investigation, to do your interviews, to do your depositions, to gather your evidence. And so an employer could sort of beat the evidence gathering process by moving to dismiss your case before you've had a chance to try and prove your case. And what I would like to have this say, frankly, and I think I'm going to reword this amendment, it would say at any time after the issuance of an accusation and fair time for investigation, and then let it go on. I'm going to withdraw amendment number 4, make amendment and move a new amendment 4, which would be conceptual and would insert the words on page 4, line 15, after the word accusation and comma, insert, and a fair time for investigation, comma.
Representative Guerra, would you be amenable to an amendment to the amendment that says and a reasonable time?
Sure.
Is there an objection to amendment number 4?
Well, because this is substantive enough, I'd like to object and have Mr. Nordstrand speak to it.
Mr. Nordstrand?
Madam Chair, I'm Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division in the Department of Law. Speaking to the amendment, first it's important to understand that at the time an accusation is issued, the investigation, which is a term of art under the statute, has already occurred. So it would be just by operation of the events. Remember, we have complaint filed, investigation conducted, substantial evidence finding, accusation issued. So that's the process. I think we can assume that the commission will use good judgment in how it allows summary judgment to be practiced. This would be like trying to codify, I think, say Rule 56 of the civil procedure, where you'd say you could have an extension of time, for example, under Rule 56F, to conduct discovery before you have to face summary judgment. I don't really think it's necessary in the statute to codify that specific process. They have broad regulatory authority to determine how they do summary judgment. All we're trying to do here is to encourage a summary judgment process. And, you know, we could recodify, I guess, all of Rule 56 in here if we wanted to make it clear what summary judgment means, but we weren't trying to get that specific.
I'll maintain my objection based on that.
Madam Secretary,
going to call Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I actually put those words in the wrong part bill. Let me withdraw amendment number 4. Okay. I withdraw amendment number 4.
4A.
Why don't I just...
4A.
4A. Why don't I move amendment number 4A, which would say... at page 4, line 17, after the word shows, insert, comma, and after a reasonable time for investigation, comma.
I'll object because that's pretty ambiguous. Reasonable time, we see this in court constantly. What's a reasonable time? I think the procedure and process is pretty
Mr. Nordstrand, what is on... What is the, 56F?
Right, under the...
What's that standard? Where you go back and you...
Off, but basically it says that an extension of time to conduct discovery will be not unreasonably withheld by the court in order to respond to a motion for summary judgment.
Madam Chair, that's a very good rule, but that doesn't apply in Human Rights Commission proceedings. So there's a very good rule in the courts, and without the insertion of the language that we have.
No, Representative Guerra, all I was trying to do is, I always like get that point, but I think that's a good exception to the rule in cases where you need it, and I was trying to think about how we could make the language that's easily identifiable and recognizable because of that court rule to place that in this statute, and it doesn't appear it would work. But Representative Anderson's point was, what's a reasonable time for investigation? How would people know how to weigh that? So I was trying to think about something that was more identified. Representative Coghill?
I don't know if it's inherent in the language, but maybe somebody could help me understand the process of finding out if there's a genuine issue of material fact, because it seemed to me that in that phrase, you're going to have some time frame anyway to make a determination. So it seems like it's already built into this and would be probably at the discretion of the commission, it seems to me. And I'm open to discussion on that.
Well, and just my limited response, and Representative Guerra and Commissioner Nordstrand or Deputy Commissioner could give you more, Deputy Attorney General. But the standard is in place for what's called summary judgment, and it's always been a genuine issue of material fact. If there's no genuine issue of material fact, but that's why there are these exceptions, because sometimes you might need a little extra time to put together your view, the evidence of your view that there is a genuine issue of material fact that you want, because once summary judgment is granted, your rights are extinguished. It's over. Done. And so that's the question, is just, do you want to have some time to pull together facts if you think there is a
Chair, and my question would be, in coming to that determination, there must be a reasonable search into that matter before a summary judgment, and I'm open to that discussion.
Yeah. Mr. Nordstrand, do you want to?
Once again, I think that we're delving into the details of regulatory process here that could easily, I mean, we have a whole process that goes on after this. For example, discovery is allowed under the Human Rights Commission rules as provided for under the civil rules, and all of that can be dealt with here. I mean, I don't know how you could get to a genuine issue of material fact determination without affidavits, without sworn testimony, or you couldn't reach the conclusion without having done some discovery in the form of admissible evidence.
Yeah, I think, and just to be fair, I think where Representative Guerra's concerns probably stemmed is that a plain reading of it says, at any time after the issuance of an accusation, the executive director, who we don't know who that is, frankly, that's a political position. So I could say I like the executive director now, I may not like the executive director 5 years from now, or the person charged in the accusation. That person's going to be pretty angry, pretty defensive, probably want to dismiss what they've been accused of. At any time after the issuance of an accusation, either of those parties can petition for a summary judgment decision. So I think what we're trying to just make sure of, I fully recognize and believe that summary judgment motions are right, because that is where you can prevent frivolity, in my opinion. You know, where someone truly doesn't have a genuine issue of material fact, but
if I could, it's clear to you should know that the first sentence, the one you just read, is in fact what is the rule in the court too. At any time after a certain period of, at the beginning of a pretrial order, you can move for summary judgment. The question is, when can you order summary judgment? Sort of sentence number two is the operative concern, it seems to me. And you know, the civil rule just says that the judge can order a continuance to permit affidavits to be obtained or depositions to be taken or discovery to be had or make such other order as is just. You know, you could add all that in, but again, recognize that the commission's regulatory procedures, and they're here, they could probably address this, as I recall, incorporate references to the civil rules as a means of setting up their system. For example, the rule on depositions, the rule on those various things are simply incorporated into their rules to allow their process to go forward, and I think they could probably just incorporate the procedure under Rule 56 if
sure.
they wanted to,
sure.
and that would be fine.
Would Kelly Fisher or Grace Merkus, either of you, are you on the line, Ms. Fisher or Ms. Merkus? Are you following the discussion, and would you care to comment?
This is Commissioner Merkus. Excuse me, I have a bad cold. I am listening to the conversation, but I'm not really too up on the legalese, if you will, so I guess I would have to agree with Mr. Norris in what he's saying.
And this is Mr. Fisher here as well. Chair, can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Yeah, we do basically follow the civil rules in the hearing unit as we advance through discovery and prepare to go to administrative hearing.
Yeah, and I guess just one other thing I want to say on the record is that one of the concerns I have and why this committee is looking at this so carefully is that a lot of these folks are brand new now. You've got a whole commission here that is acting in a quasi-legal capacity dealing with huge concerns, potentially. And I want to know how it plays out. And my deepest apologies to Commissioner Merkes, but you just confirmed my worst fears. You know, well, we're just going to follow what Mr. Nordstrand says. That sounds great. I don't want to hear that. I want to know that these commissioners understand that there's a process that they follow. And I want to know that it's fair. So the more that's in here, the better, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. See, we're going back, we're going around and not addressing the issue. If there is a commission rule somewhere that says you'll never issue a summary decision until there's been sort of ample time to investigate and prove the case, I'm fine. But nobody's pointing that out to me. And if we pass the statute that says once the accusation comes out, the commission is allowed to grant the petition to dismiss the case, I don't know where it is in the statute that says, but wait a second, but not until the person has their time to do some more investigation. See, the first sentence says the commission has done its investigation to file the complaint. But you might need more the victim might need more time to say, hey, you've come up with your base case, your most minimal case, but there's this witness and that witness and that witness I think you should talk to before you issue your decision. We need something in here that says that they have a right to do that. The language I've pointed out would give them that right. If you think there's some other language somewhere else in the law that nobody's pointing out to us, show it to us, but I don't see it anywhere.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, so we're clear here, the executive director would be moving for summary judgment on behalf of the aggrieved person, never the other way. So this is their right to seek summary judgment without going to hearing, that they're basically a determination of discrimination, or it might be a determination of some measure of damages or something like that. It would be, and I understand your fear would apparently be the opposite, is that the charged party would be able to move for summary judgment. Just so we're clear how the court rule works, by comparison, you know, the courts are not required. Basically, Rule 56F says is, if someone moves for summary judgment against you, which they can do at virtually any time after the filing of the case in a period for answer, you can ask the court, hold up, let me have time to do discovery. And I can't see any reason why a hearing officer, and that's hearing officers that hear these cases, it will be, under this bill, would be from the administrative law judges panel, they will allow a reasonable time upon request. I mean, I don't see... It seems to me to be obvious that someone would do that if you're a hearing officer. But, you know, if language needs to be added to do that, you know, there are all different aspects of Rule 56 that have to do with the kind of evidence that you need. All there are various things that you might take out of summary judgment practice and put in this statute if you want it to be complete. And one aspect of that would be, I guess, the discretion to not act upon a motion for an extension of time. But remember, it's the burden of the party seeking the extension to get the extension of time. There are deadlines, for example, in the rule here that have to do with how long you have to respond to a motion for summary judgment. We could include those as well.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nordstrand, you keep referring to Rule 56. That's not, unless you show me someplace in this law, Rule 56 doesn't apply, and that's why we're trying to come up with something. So you're telling me that in the courts would follow Rule 56. That's great. But you're rewriting the whole hearing process here. You're eradicating the existing hearing process and coming up with a brand new section that does not have a single word that says that we should give the victim a reasonable time before the decision is rendered after the complaint is filed. So we're talking past each other. If there's language somewhere in the statute, show it to me. But I don't see it anywhere here, and if you want to say, well, we should just adopt Rule 56, that's fine with me, but I don't see anywhere where Rule 56 is adopted. So short of some language in here giving people a fair amount of time to prove their case, I'm worried that, the employer will have the right to move to dismiss a case the moment the accusation is filed.
Just for a hypothetical, because Mr. Nordstrand, I think, understands the process better than anyone here, and using Representative Guerra's amendment kind of on the periphery of the example, because I still don't agree, and I think you're just going to make people, if any complainant loses, they're going to say, wait, and they're going to say, thank God for that one line, because you didn't give me reasonable time. The legislature didn't define it either. Thank you, Rep. Guerra. They said reasonable time, and you didn't give it. So everyone will challenge. Every single one will challenge if they don't get what they want in their accusation against the employer, I assure you. But that being said, could you go through the process, just really quick hypothetical? You know, Joe Schmo says, hey, I'm Asian, and you're discriminating against me because I'm Asian or some ethnicity to the employer. Then really quickly, what's the process, and where is Representative Guerra asserting that there will be a failure for this person to grieve through the process?
The process is that the complaint is filed. The commission staff assists the person in filing a complaint. It's made under oath. It's then subject to investigation by the commission staff and investigators assigned. They go around and they take statements, written statements from folks, and find out what happened. They interview, usually many times it's an employment case, I'll use that as an example. They interview the employer, the employee, other people involved in the company, and they come to a conclusion based upon the evidence they've uncovered, including personnel files and that sort of thing, whether or not there's substantial evidence of discrimination. If the executive director, in consultation with the investigator, determines there is substantial evidence of discrimination, then under this bill what would happen is the commission, the executive director's staff, would prepare an accusation, more something like a formal complaint we might see in court, which initiates this kind of Human Rights Act claim in the court system. And then we would get to, as it stands now, that pretty much happens, except the formal accusation part. The commission sometimes drafts a separate new complaint and sometimes doesn't. This just requires it. And, you know, presently, under their regulations, they allow motions. They have a rule that says you can make motion for certain things. It's just they don't have provision for summary judgment as one of the kinds of motions. So their motion practice now is not governed by the statute. It's governed by their regulations. And so we're basically saying, because of that substantial evidence test and the requirement to go to a hearing, that's evidence in the Meyer case, we think the statute needs to say you can get summary judgment without going to a hearing. It needed that statutory authorization. And we described it in terms of the genuine issue of material fact.
And then, Madam Chair, just last question. Thank you for the latitude. Then, should Representative Guerra's amendment pass, then what different would that make from what already it will occur through the bill?
I don't think it will make any difference. Basically, it's going to continue to be up to the hearing officer to determine whether or not it's reasonable to grant summary judgment at a given time based upon the facts that have been presented and the opportunity to conduct discovery. I mean, what we're not talking about here, by the way, and I use the word investigation in the amendment, I think at the very least we should use a different word, for example, discovery or something else, because investigation is the process that happened prior to the accusation. It's a term used in the Act. And I mean, we're certainly not against there being a reasonable time for discovery. The question is whether it ought to be in the statute or in the rules that they already have, and they do have rules on motions or in their own regulations.
Madam Chair, if we want to let the Human Rights Commission come up with the rules, that's fine. We could say something like, after a reasonable amount of time as provided by rules adopted by the commission. I'd have no problem with that. I just don't want this new language to be used as an excuse to not have rules like that. So,
Mr. Nordstrand, is there either saying in a reasonable time for discovery or in a reasonable time for discovery as provided under rules adopted by the Human Rights Commission? Is there language that, just so that we could be assured?
I would say not necessarily time, but maybe the word opportunity for discovery, because time is kind of irrelevant, basically.
Yep.
Okay.
So if we said, and a reasonable opportunity for
discovery
pursuant to rules adopted by
Rights Commission?
I think just the commission would be the right word to use.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I withdraw amendment number 4A.
Okay.
I would move amendment 4B,
okay,
which would be at page 4, line 17, after the word shows, comma, the following words. After a reasonable opportunity for discovery, pursuant to rules adopted by the commission, comma.
I'll object just for one small part of that discussion.
Okay.
The discussion then is, do we want to say a reasonable opportunity and let that be flexible within the commission, or do we want to mandate that they come down with the rule that goes beyond that? Because it seems to me that that's the only other alternative, and then are we going to create the same problem that we just tried to dodge, and that is create places where they can argue over the discussion of what that rule is rather than just a reasonable opportunity, which, because, I mean, it's here you have if the record shows and a reasonable opportunity. I think that gives a huge latitude. And so I think just a reasonable opportunity without having to make them make up more rules on it is reasonable to me.
A reasonable opportunity for discovery and then forget the pursuant to rules?
Yeah.
Mr. Nordstrand?
Certainly within their broad powers to establish regulations to implement the legislation, without saying they could adopt rules to effectuate that standard, they could adopt rules. I mean, for example, they have to adopt rules on timing for motions, various things. So we could probably just take that out.
Madam Chair, I recognize that, but I think they would be compelled to do something if we said that in statute. I don't know that we need to. I don't know that we need any more rules. I think a reasonable opportunity is.
You want to make an amendment to the amendment?
I'll make the amendment to the amendment, Madam Chair, that we take out pursuant to rules, how was it?
Adopted by the commission.
Right.
Is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment? Okay, hearing none. The amendment as amended, 4B, is before us. Is there an objection to that amendment, 4B? Hearing none, 4B carries. Representative Guerra.
Okay, Madam Chair, why don't we do amendment 5, which is page 4, line 28. That doesn't seem to correspond to the bill I have in front of me. Are we in the...
Yeah, it is.
Am I looking at the wrong version of the bill?
No.
You guys are on the G version. I'm not on the G version, so I've lost my bill somehow.
Page 4, line 28, it says the commission may not order an award of non-economic or punitive damages in a case, and you want to take out non-economic, and then page 4, line 30... Following the word discrimination, you want to insert nothing in the subsection prevents an award of non-economic damages, including damages for emotional injury.
Yeah. That's right. I move amendment number 5, Madam Chair.
Objection?
Oh, is there going to be a war on the floor if this passes?
Madam Chair,
have us here.
Here's
you won't solve even not the next
Madam
stage.
Chair, in these cases, there's already a cap on. There's already a cap on damages for these cases. There's not. Oh, I'm almost positive there is. There's no cap on
appropriate relief.
Okay. Boy. All right. Madam Chair, here's the point of the amendment. And frankly, if you want to come up with
it, point.
If you want, no, it's actually much different than what we argued on the floor. The Human Rights Commission almost grants.
Currency, I want to do a hypothetical. The lawyers.
Tom, stop. Representative Guerra. Stop.
Let me address the real point, and then we can talk about the what you guys think is the point. In sexual harassment cases, you don't have lost wages. You know, somebody grabs you where they shouldn't grab you. Somebody harasses you at work. You bite your lip, and you go to work the next day. You don't lose any wages. You have your only damages are your damages for being harassed, your emotional injury damages. That's these non-economic damages. It's the only thing you have. If you don't allow a victim of sexual harassment to get non-economic damages from the Human Rights Commission, they're not going to get lost wages because they don't have any of those. You're saying here they can't get punitive damages, they don't have any of those. Unless they go to a doctor, they're not going to have any medical damages. What's the point? They're not going to get anything from the Human Rights Commission.
Representative Guerra, would you accept an amendment to the amendment that allowed punitive damages instead of non-economic?
Let's talk about that for a second. Okay. Punitive damages, you're only entitled to on a higher standard of proof, reckless or intentional conduct. I suppose...
Outrageous, grabbing your private parts?
But punitive damages are the amount you set is the amount needed to punish the behavior, right? I guess we could accept that.
Just for me... I think when you're talking about that kind of conduct that you describe in your fact pattern, and if it is punitive, I mean, if it is outrageous that way, I don't have a problem with punitive damages.
Here's the problem, Madam Chair, and this is more detail than you want to get into. In the law says in determining the amount of punitive damages, you should look to see how much the compensatory damages were. If the compensatory damages are zero because we don't allow emotional injury, then a multiple of zero, let's award 30 times the amount of compensatory damages, 30 times zero is still zero. So unless we spent some time...
Or on the equation, because I know it's also the amount of damages to punish, so or to send the message, is it an either-or equation? Because I know there's a multiplier on the compensatory amount, but...
Can we back up the Madam Chair and ask Mr. Nordstrand what the current procedure is? Can the Human Rights Commission actually say, hey, in that hypothetical...
Why is this in here, I guess? Yeah.
You were ethnically discriminatory. We've gone through the process that you just said. You owe money. I didn't realize they could do that. I know they can upgrade, change. I'm reading what is currently the higher reinstatement.
Chair Representative Anderson, the intent of the... The changes to this section, as well as the next page, were to, for the ordinary person who's reading the statute, to try to understand what they can and can't get under the current law. The current law, and I think we could perhaps short-circuit some of this because there's a constitutional impairment to the amendment that's being proposed. What the current law says, under the present statute, any appropriate relief, the courts have concluded that any appropriate relief for purposes of an administrative agency does not only includes payment of direct calculable pecuniary loss. No, there's no power, and this is under the current statute, and you could change that, but presently there's no power to award compensatory or punitive damages under this statute. We were just trying to reflect that in the statute so people would know that. And they would know, for example, if they go to court, and that's another case that's interpreted, a different section of the jurisdiction of the Superior Court to say, if you bring a Human Rights Act case in the Superior Court, you can get compensatory and punitive damages. Now, here's the operative concern, though. There's a case called Loomis. It's a Human Rights Act case from 1976 that says, in the instant case where part of the relief sought is compensatory and punitive damages, we believe that Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution guarantees the parties the right to a jury trial. Now, what this means, and what Article 1, Section 16 says, in civil cases where the amount in controversy exceeds $250, the right of trial by jury 12 is preserved to the same extent as existed at common law. What that means is, you might know, common law claims legal claims for compensatory damages and punitive damages, and they're considered legal claims, require a trial by jury in Alaska. Equitable claims, traditionally courts where judges sat and decided themselves, and in fact, before that, church court sat, were allowed to award restitutionary and equitable relief. Go do that. Stop doing that. And then it's been expanded to include the power to make a person whole. We, in fact, this issue, this question of what happens if you give a human rights type commission the power to award compensatory and punitive damages, that very same issue was addressed in Hawaii in a case in 2003, where they had virtually the same constitutional provision, and they amended their Human Rights Act to say you can award compensatory and punitive damages, which is basically non-economic and punitive damages. But what they did, and this is where I want to be very clear about what is constitutionally impaired and what isn't. It is perhaps constitutional to add this to the commission's powers. But what Hawaii had to do was, and this is kind of extraordinary, what Hawaii had to do was, recognizing the right to a jury trial, what the Hawaii court did was, we hold that a respondent who appeals a final order from the Hawaii Human Rights Commission is entitled to a jury trial on any claims that form basis for the award. So what they do, if you can imagine, they go through the whole Human Rights Commission process. If the Human Rights Commission in Hawaii awards punitive or compensatory damages, when you appeal, now you appeal to Superior Court for agency review level. What happens in Hawaii, you get a de novo jury trial on the issues that were raised at the Human Rights Commission because you have to have your right to a jury trial. So that's the problem. There's a reason why the courts have separated the equitable authority from the legal authority, and it's Article 1, Section 16 of the Alaska Constitution.
Representative Kara.
I don't think we probably have the time to deal with this the way we need to here. Mr. Nordstrom, see, the reason why I don't think we're denying anybody the right to a jury trial here is the Human Rights Commission is an alternative for people to go to. If they want to go to court, they can. So I don't think anybody would be being denied the right to a jury trial because they could just opt to go to court to deal with their issue. In Hawaii, is it the same? Does going to the Human Rights Commission then deny somebody the right to choose to go to a jury trial? And is that why perhaps the court in Hawaii is trying to find some way to guarantee the person the right to a jury trial because they've lost their right to a court action in Hawaii by going to the Human Rights Commission?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, in Alaska, the responding party does not have the power to opt into court. That is the party that loses the right to go have a jury trial. Yes, it's true that a complaining party could choose to go to the Superior Court as an alternative to the Human Rights Commission, but the other party in this case, and in fact, the complainant is not actually a party in the Human Rights Commission. It's a claim by the Human Rights Commission against an employer or someone with a hotel or whatever. So the problem is that the employer, for example, does not have access to a jury trial. That's why in Hawaii, when you're all done and you've got an award against, say, an employer of punitive damages of $1 million, they get to go have a jury trial on appeal.
Get it. Representative Kara?
Madam Chair, I think we probably need more time to flesh this out, and the answer still is, under the proposal by Mr. Nordstrand, that if you're a victim of sexual harassment and you bite your lip and you go to work, you get nothing. I guess I don't know the constitutional analysis and how to get around that, but that doesn't seem right. That's the exact point of the Human Rights Commission. If you have a small case, you can't hire an attorney, you have minor damages, but you want to stand up for yourself, you go to the Human Rights Commission, and they can't do anything for you. They can tell the person not to do it again, but the person already knows they're not allowed to do it again.
What are the remedies that you give? So they're equitable in nature. It's injunction. You could probably also force, I guess, the employer to keep them employed if they wanted to not retaliate against them.
Well, that was what, Madam Chair.
They're listed, in fact, Madam Chair, on the next page rather elaborately, and that was our desire, was to try to list out what kind of remedies are available. But if I could, we're not attempting to change the law at all. We're trying to describe the law so people understand it. The McDaniel case in 1981 in Alaska said that the commission has the power to award damages extends only to those situations where there is some direct, calculable, pecuniary loss, such as back pay or housing expenses. And it goes on to say the commission does not have the authority under AS 1880 to award compensatory and punitive damages to complainants. That's all we're trying to describe here.
Madam Chair, then if Representative Guerra's amendment passes, if he doesn't withdraw it, then he said, I understand. You're like, I'm frustrated because, okay, so they reinstate their job, but, that there was this discrimination, and that's not good. And I agree with you.
It's a separate
concept. But conversely,
concept.
If it passed, then couldn't they say, well, no, you're going to pay $300,000 because the person suffered? I mean, and that concerns me, too.
Well, that doesn't concern me as much as the part about what the Hawaii case. I think it needs to be fleshed out more. But...
What about a fine? What about if you're a victim of sexual harassment, since you don't want them to get non-economic damages? We have this question whether they're allowed to. What about authorizing the Human Rights Commission to allow a victim of sexual harassment money in the form of a fine from the employer?
Through the chair, I don't know. It seems to me that you could, that could be implicating criminal issues. I mean, I've heard of civil penalties. A fine, I think, is a criminal act.
And civil penalties.
But it's certainly possible, but the question becomes whether or not we aren't simply substituting a name for punitive damages. Punitive damages is an amount of money designed to punish a party for having committed a wrong that's, you know, reckless indifference or outrageous conduct. And it's clear that, you know, the right to a jury trial would be impaired in that circumstance. And I don't know whether under that circumstances it could be done. Certainly, if an amendment, if we would be willing to work with you to look at the possibility, but I can't sit here and say whether that's constitutional or not. We haven't looked at that.
Representative Coghill.
Just so then help me understand how Section 11 would be applied, and that would be the somebody who unlawfully discriminates could be guilty of a misdemeanor and subject to fine of $500 or 30 days or both. Help me understand then how that falls into it, because it certainly goes over the $200 limit.
Well, that is a criminal matter, not a civil matter through the chair.
The misdemeanor delineates it. So, but that is a remedy then that is available.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, it is. As you recall, the constitutional section referred to civil damages.
How often does anyone really ever pursue criminal charges? Has it ever happened?
Sure, I'd have no idea. I'd have to check with the commission or else maybe the criminal division of the Department of Law, but I suspect it's very uncommon.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
This is a very complex bill. I don't know what, what discussions have taken place about this bill, but it would seem to me to be that since we don't have answers to many of these questions by the proponent of the bill, that maybe we should form a subcommittee and work on this bill over the summer, because if we don't, we're passing a bill that we don't have answers to very important questions on.
I'm amenable to that. Is there a rush that you see, Mr. Nordstrom? What would be the rush, I guess?
The Human Rights Commission has, for the last 10 years, been suffering under the burden of the Meyer decision and the requirement that virtually every case that's filed with any evidence at all proceed to hearing. Not only has the Human Rights Commission itself suffered under that burden, but everyone who has to respond to Human Rights Commission complaints. It's a very expensive process. Now, if in some way this language about non-economic and punitive damages is troubling, all we were trying to do was to tell people what the law is that existed now. Remove it. The law will remain the same. But I don't believe that it's a defect in the bill to not have done additional things that we weren't intending to do. Certainly next year, later this year, tomorrow, another bill could be introduced to make other changes. But this was designed to clean up some things in the bill, make sure everybody understood the remedies that were available so they'd know that up front, and allow the commission to get about the important business that it has to do without taking unnecessary cases to hearing and without exposing employers to enormous attorney's fees that are not recoverable. Remember, these employers go all the way through this process. They pay lawyers tens of thousands of dollars to defend themselves. If they're found to be not liable, they are not allowed attorney's fees recovery as they are in court. And we're not suggesting changing that, but we are suggesting that this has gone on long enough.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kaka?
And I agree. I think that this is not going to be the first time that this committee is going to be talking about punitive damages in all kinds of venues. But I think the process issues that have been identified here seem compelling enough to me to move forward on it. So I would suggest that we don't. I understand the remedy for we're always going to be seeking places for how remedies can be formed for those who are discriminated against. But we also have to recognize that the other side is equally true, that just by accusation there's an inherent discrimination to the employer that needs to be somehow brought to balance, which is out of balance. And so I would hope that we would move this forward and continue working on that balance.
And Madam Chair, not on the behalf of the employer or employee, but on behalf of the procedure. I don't want, because, right, we don't want to get into employer versus employee, like workers'
so
comp. I mean, this
explain
is
to
procedure.
Me, Mr. Nordstrand, so right now what's been happening is that under the Meyer decision, if I bring a claim and I say that, you know, my employer has grabbed my breasts, has humiliated me, made me demoted me, whatever they've done, sexually harassed me on a regular basis, and I bring that claim, and I don't have enough money to hire an attorney, so I look around and I decide, okay, I'm going to go to the Human Rights Commission. I go to the Human Rights Commission, and I bring this complaint forward. What you're saying is right now, it proceeds to trial.
Madam Chair, it proceeds to trial if there's a finding of substantial evidence. That's the term of art in the statute. The problem developed in the Meyer case when basically the commission was arguing that they have prosecutorial discretion within that concept of substantial evidence, that they can decide to take the best cases and leave others behind if they don't think that, if the likelihood of success is low or in various other things, just like a prosecutor would in a criminal case, choose to expend government funds to go forward with a case or not based upon the likelihood of success, the public policy behind it, all of that. Well, what the Meyer case said was that it basically lowered the standard of evidence necessary in the sense it, it described the standard of evidence necessary to be very low. And as a result, it's made it very difficult for any kind of case to not go forward. Very often, even now, even after the standard, the commission will conclude through its process or the executive director that there is no substantial evidence. That's subject to appeal to the Superior Court. We do those appeals. And very often, it's reversed still. So it's very difficult for them to figure out what that standard is. And what the Meyer case did was essentially compelled a lot of cases that would not, may not be the best use of the public time and effort to go forward because they're very likely to fail. And because the parties here, the aggrieved person doesn't really have an incentive necessarily not to keep going forward other than, the process is certainly difficult and can be difficult, but there's no financial incentive to settle anywhere except keep going forward, and the employer in most cases is the one that has a financial incentive to settle. So the system gets a little out of whack.
What I'm going to do is set this bill to the side and think about it for now so that I can at least bring up the folks that are in the room on the property eviction one. Thank you, Mr. Nordstrand. I appreciate it. Okay, so we have 137. There's a blank committee substitute that needs adopting. Representative Dahlstrom, can you help me with that?
Wait, please. Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the CS for.
Oh, pardon me. Good point. Let me take a brief at ease. Tell us about Senate Bill number 137.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me testify for the committee today. SB 137 is meant to clarify that institutions exempted under state law from the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act do not have to comply with certain other statutes that outline actions that need to be taken by individuals and companies that are currently governed by the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act. Institutions outlined under Alaska Statute 3403-330B are exempted for a reason. These public or private institutional entities, such as hospitals, schools, counseling centers, or higher educational establishments, are not compatible with the heightened protections that were designed for residential renters. The University of Alaska is the one that asked Senator Seekins to carry this legislation. The legislation stems from a few rare cases where disruptive students have used the court system to stall evictions from their unit till it was most convenient for them. These students' actions or infractions were way beyond what was allowed under their student housing contract, and because of their actions, the university needed to remove these students from the housing before their disruptive behavior started affecting other students in more detrimental ways. The Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act was designed to alleviate injustices inflicted on residential renters by unscrupulous private landlords. Though there are many variations from state to state, most of the provisions are basically the same. The state of Alaska's Landlord-Tenant Act is taken almost verbatim from the National Landlord-Tenant Act outlined in the Federal Fair Housing Act. This bill is meant to fix the discrepancy between the legislative intent of the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act and the recent lower court decisions regarding the eviction removal of individuals residing in a residence that is owned by an institution described under 3403-330, which is a subsection of the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act. In your packets, you can see I included 3403-330, and it states in Section B, unless created to avoid the application of this chapter, the following arrangements are not governed by this chapter. And Section 1 of that says, residents at an institution, public or private, if incidental to detention or the provision of medical